From the Cold War to propaganda and the deep state, Pella Neuroth-Taylor on today's News Talk TNT.
Welcome back to the second hour of the Pella Neuroth-Taylor Show on this Thursday afternoon. So our first guest today after News Talk and Sweeper is Işık Abla, who's born in Istanbul. She was beaten about and treated very badly and moved to the United States, where she now has a very popular broadcast, which spreads the message of Christianity. And using a Muslim background, she tries to sort of straddle both worlds and bring about some kind of reconciliation and information to the Muslim world about the virtues of Christianity. We know that Christians have almost been wiped out in the Middle East. Our second guest, the second hour, are the couple Paul Fitzgerald and Elizabeth Gould, old friends of mine who come on again, who will be drawing on their extensive insights of the Middle East and Afghanistan. They've made documentaries about that area and will tell us about how the neocons have done a lot of harm to peace in the world. But they also talk about Iran and maybe Israel and their relations, their thoughts about the relationship and the threat of war there. I'm just going to refer back to talk a little bit about European news first, though, on the censorship issue. Our last guest was telling us about the sort of woke critical theory run Federal Communications Commission, which is trying to crack down on all kinds of free speech aspects. Well, rest assured, America is, after all, the land of the First Amendment, but Europe doesn't have those guarantees. We have a much more authoritarian political culture, afraid to say, even the UK recently. And what interior ministers from EU member countries are supposedly signing off on in June is the Child Sexual Abuse Regulation. It's also known as chat control. Now, you've got to realize that child sexual abuse is sort of always the pretext, you know, protecting children. It goes home in it's a sort of vote-winning thing, ostensibly, because everyone cares about their children. But to cover up all kinds of deep state surveillance attempts of us. And so we mustn't take it at face value. And there's a German Pirate Party member in the European Parliament who is one of those good politicians, kind of whistleblowers, who tells us what's going on in these behind-the-scenes corridor chats, and extremely important things are decided and covered in extremely boring documents of extreme length and extreme boringness that ensure that nobody really knows what's going on, and then we suddenly find ourselves socked with it. But apparently, the latest is that EU... It could be basically an indiscriminate mass surveillance of everyone's online communications, and the true encryption deployed by these platforms will be weakened. So one exception seems to be that intelligence officials and police and military are exempted from this envisaged scanning. I mean, remember, these are just these amendments that sit there somewhere. I remember going through these amendments, the hundreds of them, and one's ticked and the other's blocked. And then you don't know which is ticked and which is blocked. So it's very difficult to carry out democratic oversight if you're a journalist based in the EU. It's a nightmare. But anyway, why is the EU exempting ministers, police and spies from surveillance? Well, basically because they think it's all going to end up with the Americans or the Israelis or the Chinese anyway. So they don't care about us private people having the online sexting revealed, because that's where most of the dragnet so far that's looking for child abuse ends up carrying out, spotting people's private sexual conversations and family photos and all the rest of it. But our elites will be exempted for that for national security reasons, but also probably because they realize where everyone will see it, not just our EU leaders. Anyway, this online thing is something to work. I'll try and talk about it again, because it's typical about the undemocratic of the nature of the EU, which will lead so many people voting for the anti-EU populists come June, when there's a European election. In France, which you don't talk about nearly enough, a 19-year-old woman, meanwhile, has been arrested for saying that foreign rapists should be deported. She faces up to 1 year in prison. In the eastern French city of Besançon, she put up a sign called Violeur étranger dehors, which means foreign rapists away. Now, actually, the mayor of Besançon, a member of the Ecologist Party, denounced the association made between migrants and rapists, and this young woman faces up to a year in prison. Funnily enough, the former Secretary of State of Gender Equality during Emmanuel Macron's first presidential term was in favor of deporting foreign rapists. So this young woman was only saying what was actually government policy until recently in France. And I just want to add my own two cents. I made a documentary called Cancel Nation, which was itself canceled, except in US markets, because US is still more open place. I sold it to Amazon Prime, but it wasn't, couldn't be shown in Europe, where I pointed out a guy worked in a meat factory in Sweden or something. I mean, a really sort of blue collar guy, and was really upset with immigration. And he went through every single statistic, wrote every single district court in Sweden, and found out that rapists, people from who just arrived, immigrants, you know, from Muslim countries, usually Afghanistan or Somalia, had like super much higher rates of rape than carried out by white ethnic Swedes. And if you're kind of being in a forgiving mood, you could say, well, they've just come from war zones and they've probably haven't had sex in a very long time, and they can't get local women, so they have to kind of rape them. But so I can believe that statistic. And of course, it should be part of the mix in the discussion about immigration in a free society, but it isn't. Anyway, we've got Basil Valentine coming on to talk more about Israel and Iran, I guess, after a very quick break. This is the Pelle Neroth-Taylor Show on...
Bringing you a world view.
I like to hear what's going on around the world.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth-Taylor Show. We've got Basil Valentine, a political editor, with us. What's happening in this hour?
We're still sitting, waiting with bated breath to decide what the Israelis are going to do next vis-a-vis Iran and Rafah, for that matter, with, of course, this Security Council vote later today on full membership of the United Nations for Palestine, de facto recognition of a Palestinian state. 99.99% certainty that the United States will veto it. But if the US veto it and everybody else votes in favor, then that will send out a strong signal, shall we say. Interesting to see what Britain and France do. My guess is that they will abstain. I very much doubt that they will vote for immediate full membership of the United Nations for Palestine. But I want to pivot to another story which you brought my attention to earlier today, which is that United Kingdom insurers are refusing to pay for Nord Stream because the blasts were government-backed or created. The defence of Nord Stream AG's insurance companies has been filed, and Lloyds and Arch argue that the damage was inflicted by or under order of a government, and therefore they don't need to pay according to the fine print of their policies. Now, they may well have to prove this in court. One would imagine so. I shouldn't think the claimants, the appellants would... just sort of back down on the basis of, oh, well, it was a government and therefore we don't have to pay, with a wave of the hand. So therefore, they're going to have to prove this in court. Now, does that mean they have to identify the actual perpetrator? I think not. I think what the insurance companies will do is simply set out a case that the level of sophistication, manpower, explosives, actual logistics of the operation would require a government without naming it. I think that's what they'll try and do. I think they'll simply say that no private organization, other than perhaps Spectre from the James Bond novels, would be capable, would have the wherewithal. No criminal or terrorist organization could possibly have the wherewithal to carry out such an act. Therefore, it must de facto have been done by a government, although they won't say who.
Do you know anything about the structure of Lloyds? I can't remember. It's like, I used to know.
Well, you've got all these names, haven't you?
Right.
As an alternative investment portfolio, long before the days of Bitcoin, wealthy people would put their own private wealth up against potential insurance claims. Now, if there's no claim, you collect the premiums year after year after year. But when there's a claim, you suddenly have to shell out possibly eye-watering sums of money that may even bankrupt you. So, that's how it, that's basically how it works.
That's what I vaguely remember Lloyd's being constructed. It's not like other companies, basically. I mean, it's normally a steady vote money earner for people who put up their money as insurance collateral. But then along can come one payout or one scandal that can completely bankrupt them. But that's the trade-off they have to make. Normally, it earns them good money. But then, unlike they have this infinite liability, and of course, it leads me to question the sort of. I wonder if any of the people who were part of the British deep state, if they planned it, or American deep state, have also Lloyd's type investors, if you know what I mean. the kind of same categories of people, but. Yeah.
Yes. Well, you know, Liz Truss famously sent a text message, didn't she, saying that, you know, it's done, you know, and Biden made very vocal threats to Nord Stream, you know. Seymour Hersh has alleged that the United States government was responsible. The Swiss-based Nord Stream AG, who are the operators, have filed the lawsuit against the insurers for their refusal to compensate them, an attack which is estimated to cost between 1.2 and 1.35 billion euros. And Nord Stream AG is seeking over 400 million euros in damages. Be very interesting to see how that one plays out.
Well, I've got to say, we've got Eric Anderson coming on tomorrow as one of my guests, and he's a Swedish engineer who has been researching it quite a lot, and he'll give his two cents of what he thinks happened, or what he makes of this latest movement. Anything else that you've got? Anything else for us?
Well, of course, the EU's 27 heads of state and government have been meeting in Brussels. The Commission has proposed a post-Brexit deal for us Brits aged 18 to 30. So I unfortunately miss out by a year or two. The idea is that they will be allowed back into the free movement zone in what's seen as a major concession under the envisaged agreement. Both EU and UK citizens aged between 18 and 30 will be able to stay for up to 4 years in the destination country. I don't think that's a bad idea. There have been terrible labour shortages, actually, with far fewer, you know, French, Spanish, Polish students and young people coming over to work in bars and restaurants, which I must admit had a great deal of colour and vivacity to the London scene for many years before Brexit.
So it's a Brits can go to Europe and vice versa for up to 4 years, young Brits.
That's the proposal.
Young Europeans. Yeah,
that's the proposal, and I would imagine it would be the one that should Keir Starmer end up as Prime Minister after the next election. I would imagine it would be one he would grab with both hands. Meanwhile, lots of talk of Ukraine, the need to strengthen their air defences. The Turkish Foreign Ministry has issued a statement criticising the EU's leaders for their conclusions on relations with Ankara as yet another example of the EU's lack of strategic vision on Turkey and the global developments. Turkey, of course, still longing, well, last time I checked, to become a fully fledged member of the European Boys Club, Pelle.
I think they've been on that list since about 1987, you know.
Yeah, I know.
So, I mean, to see Ukraine scoot ahead just because they look a little bit more white, or so Turks will tell you perhaps after a few drinks, must be rather galling, especially as Ukraine is a failed state. And Turkey seemed really prosperous these days. It was prosperous even the last time I went there 25 years ago. And of course they say, well, we didn't want to join Europe anyway, you know, in the same way that Russia says we're not really European anyway, but they're not let into that club for some reason. I don't know. I used to be anti-Turkish and member of the EU, but now I don't care, to be honest.
Well, I think one of the reasons why Obviously, it's a Muslim country, and the EU is still vastly, overwhelmingly, nominally at least Christian. But also, it's got a very large and ever-growing population. And I think the fear amongst Western leaders is that the rest of Europe will be absolutely flooded with Turks. Not that Europe isn't being flooded with migrants of one sort or another anyway. Yeah. Thousands of people arriving on Cyprus, by the way, in recent days this week, much underreported. Thousands of Syrian refugees, of course, the consequence of our misadventure in that particular country, and the swingeing sanctions, often forgotten. Syria still under heavy sanctions, causing tremendous hardship and poverty for the citizenry.
Yeah, I've got a gripe about those who have this mainstream view on Syria run by a horrible Hitler guy. You know, as we know, it was they were subjected to terrible covert operations from the West to try to dismantle that rather stable country, which had to, Assad had to keep lots of cultures together, and it wasn't easy.
Yes.
So, yeah. Well, yeah.
And the Americans are still stealing the oil. They've absolutely no business being there. You know, all this talk we hear endlessly about the sanctity of international borders and so on and so forth. Well, you know, it's completely disregarded. The one good thing, and what a terrible price the Palestinian people have had to pay for it, is that people have started looking at these questions much more closely over the last 6 months. And they've begun to realize that the so-called international rules-based order is nothing but a hollow sham. Basically, the Americans and to a lesser extent the European Union make the rules, and they order everyone else to follow them.
That's right. And we don't have the economy or the military to back it up anymore. Well, thanks a lot, Basil. We'll have you on tomorrow, of course, as usual. And just I think that we are focusing, and more people in the West are realizing that our leaders have put us in a very difficult moral position vis-a-vis the rest of the world. And we can't be as swaggering and arrogant as we used to be. And we have to find a new modus operandi if we were to preserve our Western civilization, which, of course, the best of which, parts of which I sincerely hope we can keep. Anyway, thank you very much, Basil. This is the Pelle Neroth-Taylor Show on TNT News Talk. Back to our guests after a quick break.
TNT's State of the Nation.
So Democrats voted along party lines on the first article of impeachment, which charges Mayorkas with willful and systemic refusal to comply with the law, finding the charge unconstitutional. And yeah, there we go. So this DOA on arrival, pretty much as we expected, Timothy.
This is what makes me insane. The Democrats do with impunity what the Republicans will not scruple to do. This is exactly what I said Mitch McConnell needed to do with impeachment 1.0 in early 2020. Don't give it a hearing. Don't give it the time of day. Do not dignify it by holding a trial. It was garbage. This one is real. You know, Mayorkas is clearly systemically not complying with the law. So Democrats get away with not having a trial for a legitimate impeachment, but Republicans hold a trial for an illegitimate impeachment. It makes me nuts.
State of the Nation on today's News Talk, TNT. TNT is an independent global news talk station that does what others only say they do. TNT is a live radio and TV broadcaster that simply tells the truth 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. No one in the world does what we do, crisscrossing the globe, providing credible news and opinion all day and all night. In 2.5 years, TNT has become a credible and exciting platform with brilliant hosts and staff. It's a critical time, and we must continue to call out the misinformation and propaganda from mainstream media and their powerful sponsors. We're now appealing to our many friends and supporters around the world to go to tntradio.live and make a small donation to TNT while we seek the right investors to continue our important mission. A hoax about carbon dioxide in the climate has caused a global energy and economic disaster. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to our third guest on this Thursday afternoon on the Pelle Neroth-Taylor Show. Işık Abla was born in Istanbul in Turkey and raised in a Muslim home. She, throughout her life, she suffered verbal and physical abuse and found herself in an extremely violent, abusive marriage to a Muslim man. She earned a bachelor's degree, followed by an advanced business degree, and worked in several high-ranking executive positions from the largest corporations in Turkey and traveled around Europe. In 1996, she went to America. After fleeing from her violent Muslim husband who tried to kill her, she fell into deep depression and became suicidal. She discovered God and became an ordained minister, studied biblical studies, followed by which she attended at Yale and Harvard universities for leadership training. Today, her programs are broadcast to over 200 countries on 6 continents in multiple languages, available to up to more than 700 million people. Ishik, thank you for joining us on this show.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for spreading the truth.
You are sort of poised between the Muslim and the Christian worlds, and your mission is it to bring them together, to bring the virtues of Christianity to a Muslim audience?
Yes, both of them. And of course, shedding a light to a lot of lies that I was told and Muslims are being told as well.
So tell us about some of the lies that you're told and what you're doing to counteract that. You were told as a child.
Yes, one of the lies that we grew up brainwashed against Israel and the Jews. And we were told that Israel was the root of all the problems in the world. And we were programmed. If you tell any Muslim today that they were brainwashed, they wouldn't believe you. But of course, mainstream media is doing a very good job right now, spreading lies and brainwashing people. As I was brainwashed the way. Mm. So I grew up hating Jews and programmed to hate the Jews and Israel until I learned about God and the truth about God. And of course, we are seeing all the results today, what is happening around us and in Israel and surroundings of Israel, unfortunately.
It's interesting you're saying that Jews, because people usually often in the West make a distinction between Israelis and Jews as a kind of, even people who are against Israel say we can't be anti-Semitic. There's quite a lot of careful conversation about those things because the Europeans especially feel very guilty about the Holocaust still. So they have this anti-Semitism police in British politics, for instance. But you can be into anti-Israel. But you actually learned to hate the Jews. What were the Jews supposed to be capable of? Why were they so bad?
Oh, well, we didn't know why they were bad, but Quran already told us that they were infidels, and that included, of course, Christians as well, and they were a threat to Islam and growth of Islam, population of Islam, and that was why we were programmed to hate them in different settings, of course. It was constant talk planting a seed.
Sorry for being so ignorant, but did the Quran make a distinction between Jews and Christians? And to what extent are these two religions specifically named in the Quran?
Yes, absolutely. They are being named as infidels, Christians and Jews, and you cannot make friends for them. Of course, as secular Muslims, they don't believe that, and I have family relatives that they don't believe that part of the Quran. But if you're a good Muslim, of course, you need to study your Quran and you need to know the truth about your part of the truth, of course.
Right. But what are the words that are used? I mean, are Christians and Jews as bad as each other, or is there a hierarchy that Christians are maybe better than Jews, for instance?
There wasn't any hierarchy, but of course, Jews are being the sole owner by God, by the Torah, of their land. They are a bigger target than Christians because the land of Israel, and even more so, was given to the Jews. So their threat, because they own the promised land, and that ownership was coming by God, that created a bigger threat. And they were more of a target than the Christians, starting, if you look at the Christian history, of course.
Mm. Do you think the whole war of terror from, let's say, 2001 to 2010, you know, you had a completely different discourse on Islam than you have today, because the woke brigade have kind of almost made it difficult to discuss Islam. But I remember, I mean, I made a couple of films on the tail end of that, which were quite critical of Islam. And I'm trying to calibrate my own understanding of Islam because I'm sort of feeling, well, maybe I was too critical. I was kind of swept up in too much criticism. And now we're going too far in the other way. And now maybe the pendulum is switching towards criticism of Jews. How shall we judge Islam? How can we get it right between too much criticism and too little criticism? I'll ask you to think about that because we're going to go into a very quick news break. And then we can talk about your personal history, which is a very disturbing one, and whether it's particular to Islam, this about violence. I think it probably is, but we'll allow you to talk about it. We'll be back after a quick news break. This is the Pelle Neroff-Taylor Show, back in a minute or so with Ishik Abla.
Oh yeah?
We interrupt the regular programming to bring you some breaking news.
Breaking news.
Newsflash.
Now, TNT Radio News.
For TNT, this is James O'Neill. Washington has reportedly agreed to conditions that would govern the potential trial of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange if he is extradited to the U.S., according to media reports. House GOP leaders have introduced a new border security bill as a separate entity from Speaker Mike Johnson's recent $95 billion foreign aid packages, which includes support for Ukraine, Israel, Taiwan, and other Indo-Pacific allies.
The common housefly, caught in the clutches of the spider's web. Every move it makes just makes matters worse. Then, dinner time.
Feast on the captivating stories, videos, and helpful information on our website.
Whoa.
Dinner's ready.
Oh, man.
Escape is futile.
Just one more video.
Get stuck in our web.
TNTradio.live.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroff-Taylor Show on this Thursday afternoon. We've got Ishik Abla, who is a Christian. She was born and raised as a Muslim, and she, through her podcast and broadcasts, straddles both worlds and tries to increase understanding, I suppose, and also spread the Christian message in many, many countries with a huge potential audience of over 700 million people. Ishik, how can we get it right about Islam? You know, not too critical, but fair.
Yes. Well, Islam, first of all, we need to understand what the ideology Islam is. Islam is not only a religion, it's an ideology. And that ideology is, of course, rooted in the Book of Quran. Its book orders its followers jihad. And jihad is not only a physical war. Jihad is a struggle with infidels, which is non-Muslim. And it is in population jihad, media jihad, educational jihad, which is spreading lies about Islam is a peaceful religion. And it is an economical jihad, so forth, so on. So violence of part of jihad is only one form of jihad. And we need to really look closely to understand what a threat Islam is, not only to America or to Europe, but to the rest of the world.
Carry on that theme.
Yes.
Because it's what you're talking in a sort of, you could well be right, but you're talking in an unfavorable opinion climate where in Europe, at least, as you know, there's huge sympathy for the Palestinians on a human level, regardless of their religion. And when you say yes. that's a threat to the world, a lot of people won't buy that when they're dying in their tens of thousands.
Absolutely. And they have my sympathy, and I have Palestinian friends. We can agree to disagree, and I love them very much. We eat together. It doesn't mean that I have to hate them. I absolutely see their pain. But this is a war, and a lot of people are also suffering in Israel's side as well. However, we are seeing one nation fighting, very small nation, amongst 1.7 billion approximately Muslims, a very tiny bit of nation, fighting for her existence. And I think instead of pointing that finger to that small existing population, they need to step up and rescue their own people and instead of promoting jihad. This is how I see it, as an ex-Muslim, brainwashed and programmed, just like any other Palestinian friend that I have.
But let's say, I'll be devil's advocate now. When you look at, because I've heard this from Turks themselves. I mean, when you look at modern Turkey, they'll say, well, I mean, we're no different from, you know, the Greeks or the Serbs or whatever. We live in we're a Mediterranean lifestyle, you know, upper income, you know, whatever, 20 or 30,000, a little bit poorer than Russia, maybe even richer. I was in South Africa recently, and engineers saying, yo, you go to Turkey and they're much richer than the South Africans. And then they have kind of a sort of quasi-European Western civilization. How can you talk about, are these people secretly planning to take over the world, or what do they think? You know, are they brainwashed too?
Well, when we think of Turkey, you cannot think of only Istanbul or Ankara, the main cities that we are talking about. Turkey has also an eastern side. I've been in Turkey several places that they don't look like how I look like right now, but you can. The more eastern you go, you would be amazed of the mindset and the mentality of the people. I would call very small percentage of Turks are really modernized and think like Europeans, or they got themselves out of this Islamic jihadist mindset. But the rest of them are still Muslims, and many of them would say, I'm going to die Muslim. I was born Muslim, I'm going to die Muslim. As I say, it's not only a religion, it's an ideology. It's a fanaticism, and it's very radical and it's very dangerous.
Do you think... So give us three or four things, or remind, I think a whole younger audience doesn't, I mean, these are things we were fed or told back in 2001, 2002, but what are three or four things that are part of the Muslim ideology and that's central and why they're a threat to the West?
Number one is a whole entire world has to be Muslim for the world peace to come. And this sounds to me like very much like Antichrist. So everybody has to. And the second one, there cannot be any peace, which supports number one, unless everybody surrenders to Islam. And it is in the name. And a Muslim means who is walking obedient to Allah. And then the other one is like their reign and rule in the through the caliph, the upcoming caliph in the world. So just by this first three of them are really, really very dangerous ideologies make Islam alarming for the world.
I don't know very much except to say that I was reading that somewhere that Saudi Arabia, they made peace with Iran, and obviously they were trying to make peace with Israel. They're building this 100-mile city across the Arabian desert, and the Emiratis are planning a sort of, green development, and everyone's planning these nuclear plants. So I thought that the Middle East was moving away from jihadism and Wahhabism and whatever, and getting onto the tech bandwagon, be quite responsible and mature. But you're saying that that's not the case.
Well, here's one thing. We are talking about 1.7 billion Muslims, and I have Muslim family members. And my mom came as a Muslim woman, and she started living with me in America after my father's death last year. She wasn't hating infidels. She wasn't believing those part of the Quran. There's a percentage definitely in Muslims that they don't believe in any form of jihad. Let's make it clear. I am making a general statement about what Quran orders to people. I just want to make it clear. I have Muslim friends that they are peaceful, wonderful people, and they don't want to see bloodshed at all. They don't care for jihad. I'm not talking about that. Them. They their birth certificate says Muslim. That's it. They exist in Saudi Arabia as well. Women start driving in a few years ago. Saudi Arabia has changed and became even better than Iran right now. And because social media, in a good way, played a huge role to modernize this next generation, and their minds are being open, as with the good and the bad. But there are a lot of Muslims still, majority, I do believe it on my heart, that they are jihadists.
So we in the West, how assuming that you're right, how should we deal with or confront it? Should we take, like the West won the Cold War by a very slow and patient process of modernizing the population, or what? Can we coexist? Can we defeat them militarily? You've got 30 seconds left. To just so a very quick answer.
Well, for me, the quick answer is God's absolute truth, which is Jesus Christ, number one. And number two is the best way to defeat is, of course, we need to be vigilant and we shouldn't buy everything we are watching on media that they are giving us. And don't believe everything the media says about Islam. Islam is a peaceful religion. It's not. It's a religion. Right. Muslims can be peaceful. Islam is not.
Okay. Thank you very much. Isha Kaplan, we'd love to talk to you again, more detail next time. This is the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show. We're going into our next guest after a quick break.
When I had my heart event close to 4 years ago, I was at the gym, thought I deserve a coffee, and thought I'll top up with fuel, ordered a coffee. But while I was pumping fuel, I started to get chest pains. Then it got worse and worse and worse. So then I was leaning on the counter thinking, yeah, something's not quite right. So then I went to wait for the coffee, and that's when it really, really hit. And Joy just, you know, mouthed, do you need an ambulance? And I remember nodding. I wasn't even thinking about a heart attack. I just thought, something is seriously wrong with me here. So when the cardiologist came to see me, she informed me that I'd had what they call a widowmaker heart attack. Bit of a shock when someone says, you know, you nearly died. Everybody should be aware of all the symptoms of a heart attack that women can have that aren't typical of the shoulder pain, the right arm pain. I go to the gym, I do yoga, Pilates, I swim, I go on bike rides, and yet I still had a heart attack. You just don't know, it could be you.
My dad was a farmer. The guy was bigger than life. He wasn't someone that liked to show his emotion or liked to show when he was struggling, but we all struggle. I want to show emotion to my kids. It's something that brings me so much joy. And I want them to see me working through things. Allow your kids to know that it's okay to struggle, that even dad doesn't know the answer sometimes, but we're gonna figure it out together.
Deconstructing PSYOPs, propaganda, and mainstream media garbage. Pelle Neroth Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show. Our final guests on this Thursday afternoon, old friends, filmmakers, writers, Paul Fitzgerald and Elizabeth Gould, a married couple who are going to tell us that they're going to draw upon their extensive insights from the Middle East and talk to us about several issues there. They've made films about Afghanistan, and we will maybe even delve into the history of the 13th century if we get around to that, and very interesting theories you have there. Could you welcome to the show?
Thank you. Nice to be back.
Thank you for having us.
That's a pleasure. It's incredibly interesting. Trouble is with these interviews, sometimes they're very short and we have to kind of rattle on. I just want to create continuity with the previous interview, because she was a woman from Istanbul who emigrated to America. And she says that it's almost a discourse that we haven't heard for a long time, because the Palestinians are very much in favor. And we've moved on from the war of terror, or war on terror, decided what you call it, into a kind of more of a social justice mentality, you know, an anti-white even. Do you think it's fair when she says, you know, that Islam is a threat and they're all, most of them are incredibly ideological? Is that a fair assessment from your perspective as people who've been for a long time in the Middle East?
Well, I think we learned a lot about the use of Islam as a political tool from our experience going back to the creation of really activating political Islam was Zbigniew Brzezinski during the Carter administration. And he had actually picked up a process that was already being used by the British in the 19th century to control the region. So I think that what people need to understand, this is really not about Islam at all. This is about criminals. Okay, this is about a criminal class of people, whether they're Islamic or whether they happen to be Italian. Would you call someone who belongs to the Italian mob Catholic? Would you even consider focusing on their religion? No. Their common bond is that they're all criminals and willing to do criminal things, whether it's drug running or whether it's bombing places. And they have a loyalty to the same thing with the Don, you know, the loyalty is to whatever the agenda is. So I think that's the way I would view it, that the average Muslim is not the problem, except possibly by their own ignorance about the way in which this process has been exploited against them.
I mean, for us, we saw this process developing in 1976 with the Team B report. Team B was a group of right-wing, mostly neoconservatives who got together to oppose the existing CIA's analysis of what was going on with the Soviet Union. But it was more than just an opposing point of view. It was a paradigm shift in terms of the way in which the United States functioned. And that was a result of the fact that the U.S. lost in 1975 in Vietnam, and the existing structure, the bureaucratic structure, was in ruins. So they came in and they said, well, since your bureaucratic structure doesn't work well anyway, it produced a disaster called Vietnam, then what we're going to do is we're going to put our own particular preferences into the mix. And so what's happened is that Richard Pipes, who was a Harvard professor, was put in charge of this thing called the Team B to come in with his ideological effort to overthrow the Soviet Union. And when we got to Afghanistan, which is what we noticed, we were in the middle of a documentary being distributed in the Boston area. And when the Soviets went into Afghanistan on December 27, 1979, Richard Pipes appeared on national public television and said, along with the former ambassador to Afghanistan, whom we ran into at one point, who ran into us, actually, intentionally, Ted Elliott, and who said, no, detente is over. In fact, I never liked detente to begin with. So this was Afghanistan. It was the fait accompli from 1976 and the creation of Team B. The neocons basically got into the system at that particular point, and they were directed. The direction was eventually against Palestine. I mean, I think at the core of this whole thing, I really think that's where we go back into the Middle Ages and the Crusades. I think we really are dealing with something that was started back then in terms of reclaiming the Holy Land for the West. It began with that. And I think, unfortunately, it's ending with it as well.
Just before we go back to the Crusades, and you wrote a book about the Knights Templar. It's a very intriguing theory, but the 1973 there was it was the Yom Kippur War, wasn't it? It was 73, and Russia and America, Soviet Union and America, managed to collaborate on that. And of course, this was at a time of maximum good relations between Brezhnev and Nixon, and they were good friends. I mean, Brezhnev actually cried when Nixon resigned. You know, because he was given a BMW. I mean, it's like a rather childlike, affectionate portrait of him in one of the books I read. But this collaboration actually seems to be taking place right now, because there's a piece by Seymour Hersh, who's, you know, one of America's top journalists, 88 years old and still going strong. He has a huge amount of contacts inside the CIA and the Pentagon. And he said basically this whole attack on it from Iran through to Israel was basically a theatrical performance, you know, designed to avoid humiliating anyone, but satisfying Iranian prestige. But they did it by collaborating with the Russians. So the Russians were pulling on the Iranians, and the Americans were protecting the Israelis. Now it seems the Israelis are determined to pocket that favor done to them, because America prevented Israel from organize this, basically, and are going to use the sort of American generosity and security shield to really strike at Iran, which could have unforeseen consequences. I don't know if you've followed this, because it's such a hot topic now. Maybe if you've got some thoughts about what's going on right now, we can talk about that.
Well, I have definitely come to the conclusion that Bibi Netanyahu is actually not the problem. He is going to do what he is going to do, and that's been pretty well documented throughout his whole career. In fact, you know, that's the point about why I would say he would be similar in modern era as Zbigniew Brzezinski was in the Carter administration, where everybody knew the guy's track record. Everybody knew what he was going to do. So the question is, how did they get away with it? How does Bibi get away with ultimately continuing to push the agenda down the road? And many people believe part of his motivation is he might end up in jail if this whole thing ends tomorrow. You know, that possibly is part of the motivation, but it does seem to fit the paradigm of what I consider to be, they're like the mad dogs, you know, or the berserkers. They used to have the name of the warriors that were considered very important for the tribe to win. And they would be so capable of killing that they literally call them berserkers. Well, I kind of consider people like Netanyahu and Bibi and Brzezinski to be in that category where once they set them in motion, they're going to do what they do. So it's really about the ones who have been using them. So when they get out of control, I consider it to be a reflection of who put them in power in the first place.
Well, I think too that the results of this behavior is not unexpected. You know, I want to bring to your attention something I've had on the shelf for since 2008. It's a subject called strategic survey called Known Unknowns: Unconventional Strategic Shocks in Defense Strategy Development by Nathan Freer, November 2008. Now, there's a statement on page 34 that projects into the future. Now, that's 2008. Imagine a new era of containment with the United States as the nation to be contained, where the principal tools and methods of war involve everything but those associated with traditional military conflict. Imagine that the sources of this new era of containment are widespread, predicated on non-military forms of political, economic, and violent action in the main, sustainable over time, and finally, largely invulnerable to effective reversal through traditional U.S. advantages. Now, he sees in this projection, what he sees is this new containment being of the United States and Israel. And I thought at the time, how far in the future is he projecting? Well, that's what we're looking at now. We're looking at a kind of a new era of defense planning where the weapons have changed, the political attitudes have changed. Certainly in this country, there's an enormous issue going on with anyone who goes out and protests what Israel is doing on behalf of the Palestinians, gets fired, gets labeled a terrorist, gets labeled, loses their job or whatever they might happen to be doing at that particular time, their status. So there's an enormous campaign going on simultaneously, which I don't think is really sustainable. I think that, what's going on in the Middle East is just not going to be accepted by the broad swath of people.
That paper you're quoting from, who authored it and which movement does it represent? Which party does it represent?
The paper is known as Known Unknowns: Unconventional Strategic Shocks in Defense Strategy Development by Nathan Freer. And it was published by the U.S. Army Strategic Studies Institute, .army.mil. You can find it online. Just Google Nathan Freer, Freier, Known Unknowns. And I think you can find it online. You can find a PDF of it.
But sorry, what's the significance of that? Because that's an American Army manual or paper calling for a containment of both America and Israel. I mean, why would the American Army want to contain its own country? Which segments of its own country? Is it the civilian protesters or something?
Well, basically what he's revealing is the fact that if the United States continues on its way with the policies that it used during the Cold War and doesn't radically change the way in which it views the world, it's going to wind up like the Soviet Union. The polarities are going to switch.
Well, the other point being that within these institutions, you'd always have people projecting into the future. And it's really a matter of whether any of their recommendations are actually used. So this is really not unusual. There are probably many other documents that might very well have projected even more specifically on what we're now witnessing now. And in fact, there was a big conference in 1995 about the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, and all the officials from what, of course, was now Russia, who had been involved, and American officials, including Stansfield Turner and many others, high up in the administration, basically sat down to talk about how did this happen. And one of the things that they acknowledged at this conference was that the one person who should have been there, who was most important to the whole agenda of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, was Zbigniew Brzezinski, and he wasn't there. So the idea that they often have these projections. But why aren't they listened to? It turned out when the Soviet officials, now Russian, went over their background, they basically admitted the same kind of problem, that many of the, you know, of these papers that are done to assist leadership making better decisions aren't always followed.
And we sat down with Chuck Hogan, who had run the Afghan operation for 5 years, and he told us that he was shocked. He showed up in an event at Harvard when we were talking about our book that came out, Invisible History. And he said at that meeting, he said that was in 2009, and he said, "There's absolutely," he said, "you know, I believe everything you said about the Russians not wanting to invade Afghanistan." He said, "But the idea that Brzezinski actually lured them in and then took credit for it," he said "the CIA doesn't work that way." Well, we went back 5 years later and we said, "Well, you know, what have you got to say about the whole thing? Let's just talk about it." And he said, "Can I interrupt you?" He said, "You know, I got to meet Brzezinski for the first time, and he told me, and I told him I didn't believe that thing about him luring the Soviets into Afghanistan." And he said, Brzezinski said, "Well, I did, and it was intentional." He said, "You didn't know what was going on in Langley, but I knew what we were doing at the White House would bring them in." So you had this whole coterie of people who were coming out and saying, "Brzezinski's just bragging, he didn't do that, he can't do that," or anything else. And the head of this CIA division that was in charge of doing it said he couldn't do it either. And then he discovered from Brzezinski that he had done. So you have all of these subterranean things that are going on that we don't know about that eventually become available, you know, like this physician now.
Because it makes me wonder, we can apply, that's what I've learned from studying the Cold War, is nothing is what it seems, basically. And what you see is an unprovoked attack is often somebody else basically creating the provocation first. And I think we'll find that out. I mean, a lot of people in the alternative media know that Ukraine was provoking, backed by MI6, Russia to invade. But I guess there's still a lot of people who believe the sort of Hitler idea of Putin as Hitler is going to invade the whole world. And of course, we've got what's going on in Palestine and what's going on in the Middle East now. I guess we've got who started the war. You know, was it there's rumors that the Israelis knew very well that Hamas was going to attack on October 7 and stood down to allow them to attack so that they could go into war. And similarly, what's going on in Iraq? I mean, they were losing the public opinion over Iran. Over Palestine, so they Gaza, and so they attacked Damascus and the Iranian consulate there, so they could flip the narrative. And now Iran has hit back, although apparently it's a theatrical event to minimize damage. And now, the Israelis are going to escalate because Netanyahu, as you said, he might go to jail if he ever loses power. So it's a very dangerous situation, unfortunately. But we got 2 minutes left, and we'd love to have you on again. But you will flag it up maybe for another interview. But because you did a lot of research into the 13th and 14th century politics with the Cathars and so on, so is there a sort of common alternative history red thread running through the last 500 or 600 years involving Queen Elizabeth the First and all the rest of it?
Well, you have the families, of course, that go back in that kind of to that origin in the 12th, 13th century. We've traced it back because of the Fitzgeralds being part of the invasion in 1169 of Ireland. It was written about quite a bit extensively, and that's the part that I'm directly connected to. So when you start with something that actually has a factual basis and you start looking at the relationship between various people along the way and saying, now, wait a minute, these names are the same as my own family's names. It becomes something else, becomes something different.
Quickly make a point. We actually made a presentation at the Dallas Convention on the 60th anniversary of JFK's assassination. And the paper is basically tying together what happened from the 10th century on that we feel was connected in motivational level, especially through the CIA, who referred to as Knights Templar by Wild Bill Donovan when he started the OSS. So the idea that there's a real connection, there's no question there are actually real connections to the motivation.
We can send you a copy of the speech. I think you'd find it pretty interesting.
And just if this is a test, can you talk about the Knights Templar for 30 seconds and explain who they are for an audience?
The Knights Templar were a religious order of fighting monks that was established in I think it was 1117, wasn't it? It was after the First Crusade. And they petitioned the Pope for special privileges because they were going to protect the pilgrims in the Holy Land. There is a question as to whether the whole Da Vinci Code and the whole idea of the Merovingian dynasty is all connected to what their real purpose was. And I think that if you really wanted to make a case for it, you could make a case for the fact that what's happening now in Israel is something of the fulfillment of that beginning of that particular quest.
Okay, incredibly interesting. Well, we'll have to go through that, devote a special session to that sometime. Paul Fitzgerald, Elizabeth Gould, a couple who have specialized in the Middle East and made documentaries about Afghanistan. Thank you very much. This is the Pelle and Neroth Taylor Show on this Thursday afternoon. Thank you for listening in.